From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
My guest is Barney Salzberg. Barney Salzberg is a musician, songwriter, singer, author, illustrator. He has published something like 500 picture books. He's been traveling the world talking about creativity and where ideas come from. He lectured in China and Russia through a cultural exchange program through the United States State Department. Barney is passionate about working with children, parents, teachers, organizations on the art of making mistakes and finding play and creativity in our everyday lives. His books have won numerous awards, including NAPPA Gold Awards, Publishers Weekly, and Kirkus Starred Reviews. Most recently, Melinda Gates chose Beautiful Oops as one of the top three books every child should read. He's also written Animal Kisses, Crazy Hair Day, Would You Rather Be a Princess or a Dragon? And his brand new book is called The Smell of Wet Dog and Other Dog Poems and Drawings. Barney Salzberg, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's nice to be here. Hi.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have, but thank you for joining.
It's been, I thought I'd run out of things to say, but it worked.
You haven't actually written 500. I exaggerated, but you have many books out there. How many books do you have?
In the 50 range. I'm math is not my friend.
So you've lost count.
Yeah.
When was your first book published? How many years ago?
It was 1981.
Wow. So yeah. 40 some years.
Oh yeah.
Neat. How do you, tell us about your new book, The Smell of Wet Dog and Other Dog Poems and Drawings. It's a book of poetry.
It's a book of poetry. And the irony of getting to do this now, I don't know if it's ironic, but it's kind of magical to me. When I sold my first picture book, I was working with an editor at Harper, which in those days was called Harper and Row. Mm-hmm. And I was a newbie. I just was so happy to be published and getting to be published and being in New York. It was so magical. And I was so excited after my meeting. I gathered up my work and went window shopping. And when I got to the hotel, there was about 15 messages from my editor saying, "Can you call us?" And I had inadvertently grabbed everything off of their desk. And I had Shel Silverstein's drawings for There's a Light in the Attic, which was a book of poems. And I was mortified. Nowadays we would have taken out our phone and taken pictures of everything, but I ran back without stopping at a Xerox store. And Shel Silverstein was waiting with folded arms at the elevator when I got off. And
this is the guy who stole my artwork.
Pretty much. And so from that day, and clearly being a fan of his, dreaming of doing poetry, this is it. It's finally happening. It's taken this long for me to kind of figure it out. I'm a songwriter, and you can fudge rhythm and meter in a song lyric, but when you're actually writing poetry, it's a little more complicated. And I have a wonderful editor who says, "I don't like anything that rhymes, and every book we've ever worked on together rhymes." And this is it. So I have a copy. It's The Smell of Wet Dog. And I'm a huge dog person. We have one dog that's actually ours, but two dogs live in our house, and a third visits a lot.
You don't know who these other two dogs belong
to? They just keep showing up. No, my son is in it. He's working so much that he dropped his dog off about 2 months ago, hasn't mentioned picking him up. and our other dog is thrilled having a friend. And when I met my wife, she had a puppy that was so great. I fell in love with her and thought, the dog and my wife, she'd be a great mom. And we've always had dogs.
And children. How many children do you have?
Let me count. Two.
A boy and a girl?
And a boy and a girl, yes.
And did they, when they were growing up, did they like your books, or did they say, "Could we please read more Dr. Seuss?"
They liked my books. It's funny, In their world, I was a rock star. You know, going into an elementary school, I was always mobbed by kids. And I remember going to Disneyland with my son, and he must have been in first grade. And he looked at me and he goes, "I don't think anybody recognizes you with your hat on." they were used to me being a big deal as when they were little. They learned as they got older that that wasn't necessarily the case, but it was fun while they were little. And yeah, now they're older, and my daughter has two sons, and they're collecting my artwork for their walls at the house, which is really amazing.
Oh, that's nice. So you have grandchildren. How old are your grandchildren?
I have a 11-month-old as of today, a boy named Dell, and another grandson, Rio, who is 3.5. So, yeah, Rio
Well,
thinks I've written every book that's ever been written. Even if he looks at the back flap and sees a photograph of someone else, he goes, "That's you."
was going to say, when I was talking about all of your book titles, that you'd also written, A Tale of Two Cities, but you didn't need to write it because Charles Dickens had already written it.
Yeah, I found out it was really a bummer when I turned it in. But I had pictures.
So the smell of wet dog, can you would you are you in the mood? Could you share with us some of the
Actually,
verse that you've written?
I can figure out which one I put bookmarks in. That would be really good. It must be this one. Oh gosh, I have three copies of the book on my desk and many behind me.
Yeah.
The box just
You
came.
have the whole
I have the
run.
entire edition is in my house. one of the other things that's amazing is this is all drawn on the iPad.
Really?
So I use the app Procreate, and it's been just kind of amazing. I was a printmaking student in college, and when we used to do woodcuts, you'd use a brayer to roll out the ink. I know you know about that stuff.
Yes.
And this is a brayer brush
Oh, you mean you did this on
on the iPad.
your iPad. Well,
Yeah.
was that an adjustment for you as an artist to suddenly say, I'm going to work in digital?
No, I've been working digital for years and years. I mean, I remember when I would actually send a CD with the artwork to my editor, and now I put it in Dropbox. But no, I've really switched. I swore I'd never do it, but there's an ease, and when corrections need to be made, I don't start over. It's all here, and it
So
gives you a faster layout.
you're cheating.
Shh. This one is called Mistaken. I will not wear a rhinestone collar. It's for a dog that's much, much smaller. You told me I would look much better if I wore that ugly sweater. Now I've lost my sense of humor. Do not take me to the groomer. I do not want a frilly cut. I'm really not that kind of mutt. And now you've got this tiny hat. Well, that's enough. Enough of that. I am your dog and I am faithful. It isn't that I am ungrateful. If that's the dog you'd hoped I'd be, you're mistaken. That dog ain't me.
Now that reminds me of something that happened to me. I had a little dog. I had a little toy poodle, and his name was Rags. And I didn't want to be caught dead with the toy poodle, but the dog was a stray that just came into my yard and wouldn't go away. And so
Cool.
I kept him, kind of long. I didn't do anything with his hair. I just let him be, as he was. I mean, I brushed him or whatever, but I didn't put a crazy poodle cut on him.
Foolproof, yeah.
Yeah. And my brother was working for a vet, and he goes, "Let me take your dog and have him groomed." And I said, "Well, okay, but not, any kind of crazy poodle cut. I would hate that." So he took him and brought him back, and Rags had this total poodle cut with a puffy head and a little thing around his nose and little puffy feet. And the thing was, he absolutely loved it. He was like a new dog. He was just like so happy to be, pretty. And, he's just like learned to do tricks. I mean, his whole life changed once he got his. So I always kept him in a poodle cut after that.
That's a that that's see now that would have been food for a poem right there.
For volume two of The Smell of Wet Dog.
I can read you another.
Please do.
This is a haikoodle on the top.
A
It says,
haiku.
"Doodle, doodle in my chair. There's no room for me to sit. bothers me a bit.
It's beautiful. I wish we people on the radio could see these drawings.
Yeah. And then shadow. I would be your shadow if you let me. I would follow you and you could pet me. I think I wrote some of these for my wife. Shh. Yeah.
How many dogs have you owned?
Oh gosh, I've never counted. Not as many as the guitars I have. Let me think. We grew up with Cindy. And then we had Winnie the Pooh. And well, I didn't name that one, either one. And then actually that was it, two dogs. No, and then when I got older, I got dogs when I met Susan. And so, yeah, probably four or five dogs.
It's hard because they're not long-lived enough.
No, they really blew it on that part. They don't live long enough. It's really hard. My brother won't get another dog because he doesn't want to go through that. I had a golden doodle before they were like the flavor of the month.
Yeah.
I named Arlo. And Arlo grew to be an 85-pound white golden doodle who had the looks and the IQ of a stuffed animal. But he was adorable. Everybody that saw him, people would stop me and take pictures. He was just gorgeous. He looked like something I would draw. And I did a book about him called Arlo Needs Glasses because he could not catch a ball. I would throw the ball and it would like bounce off his nose, hit him in the head, zoom over. Once I got it in his mouth, but I think he was yawning. But he only lived till six. And I swore I'd never get another dog after that. And then after about a year, I broke down and did. And I can't imagine not having one. They're just, you know, especially because I work at home and I'm here all the time. And it's like having security guards. They follow me around the house.
It's the only people who will spend time with you, Barney Salzberg.
Yeah.
Well, so you've written in the 50 number of books. And yeah. It seems like a book is almost like a doodle. You have an idea, then all of a sudden there's a book.
I wish it were that simple. You know, it is funny because when I met my wife, she'd say, "Did you color today, honey?" It looks easy. And when someone sees me drawing, it looks easy because that's what all I've been doing for the last few decades. But getting that initial idea and then fleshing it out into a working story, that takes time. And I wish there was a formula that I maybe for some writers, they have it. I don't have it. Every book comes differently. A fascinating thing about writing poetry, once I got into the groove of writing poetry, which was a new thing for me, spoiler alert, the last poem in this book is a cat. Everyone who reads the book says, "Are you doing a cat book?" And I said, "Well, you know, I like cats. I don't have any and just don't really have much to say." And one day my vet showed me a picture of her cat and told me that the cat was really sweet, but it bit. And I got in my car and wrote a cat poem. And then for the next 5 days, 38 cat poems just poured out of me, one of which happened while I was dreaming. And I woke up and wrote it down. And that will be the follow-up to this book. But it was extraordinary to be in that kind of zone and have it happen. I've never had that before. So maybe the practice is helping.
And you also make music. You make, well, I mean, how about now? Do they still make CDs? Are you still making a CD?
I don't make CDs anymore. You know, I did four kids' albums. When my kids were little, I used to bring the guitar into the bathroom when my daughter was little while she was in the bath. I love the acoustics and I just make up things and ended up recording four kids albums. In those days, they started off as cassettes and then went to CD. And now it's straight to, you know, streaming stuff. I haven't recorded a kids album for a long time. I did an adult album when I turned 65 called If Not Now, When? Because I think I've always wanted to do. And I write songs from time to time. It's a really beautiful addition when I go speak to kids or educators. I bring a guitar and it It's a great way to kind of connect with an audience to get, if you can get a bunch of adults to sing Where's My Underwear, after that, the whole talk goes well.
So you speak to educators?
I speak to educators, which is shocking to me because I was, a student who was pretty miserable in school. But I think I have compassion for kids with learning issues. I'm of the age where they weren't diagnosing us as kids. I'm sure they would have lots of special things for me now. But the idea that I get to go speak to kids at schools, I talk to them, and I can be in a room full of 500 elementary school kids and say, when I was your age, I didn't think I was smart. And the amount of kids who privately point to themselves so that I can see makes me get up and fly across the country to speak at a school at what's, 7 in the morning for me or 5 in the morning with a time change. I wished I had heard someone talk that way when I was growing up, but I'm always blown away to get invited to speak to educators too. And it's sort of evolved over the years, and I can talk to them about the creative process and how they shouldn't give up on the students they're worried about, because things can happen if you don't give up. I'm the poster child for that.
Well, Barney Salzberg, I mentioned in your introduction that you've traveled a bit, and is that part of your work? You travel?
Well, that's the funny thing. When I started, it was the opposite. You think about most people who become writers, they kind of want to. I think my stereotype is a solitude, a life of solitude. I mean, I envisioned having a farm in Sonoma County and having a barn that I went outside and worked at as I, after I milked the cows and, wrote my stories. And then they send me checks in the mail. That hasn't happened.
No.
But when they started inviting me to speak, I thought this wasn't part of the plan. And now, doing this since I'm 26 years old, I go all over the place. Schools invite you to speak all the time, but the adult talks, and when the State Department stepped in and asked me to go to Russia and China, two separate trips, it kind of put me into a different league. And that was an extraordinary experience, both places.
And when you spoke in China and Russia, no one understood a word you said. Is that
That's why it was so great.
right?
I did it, I could go on about this, but most countries learn how to speak English. And we're the ones that come in needing a translator. But I did have translators, and most of the kids spoke English. I signed more books to kids in China named girls named Pineapple.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a big name, right?
Fun story. I was in Samara in Russia, which is the home of the Sputnik.
No.
And it was a couple hour flight from Moscow, and I was speaking to a group of eighth graders. And when I finished, I was on the stage, and they asked me through the translator to stay on the stage. And all the kids lined up with their arms around each other and sang me John Denver's Country Road. I was weeping on the stage. It was something so beautiful about that leveling any differences between us that's how they wanted to thank me.
Did
So yeah.
you play music for them as well?
Oh, always, 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 always. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I brought a guitar, and it's weird because you, especially in China, I had it like, well, it happened in both countries. And I've done it. I was in Vietnam and in India. I did schools without the State Department, and you sing a line and then you vamp on the chord while the translator tells them what you just said. It kind of ruins
The
the
rhythm of
flow,
it.
but it seems to work. Song takes an hour to sing, but yeah.
You have more than 50 books and you've been writing for 40 years, so that means more than one book a year.
Right now I'm finishing three.
Really? And have your books sold enough that your publisher is always willing? They never say to you, not this one.
I don't know anyone where that's happened. It is kind of incredible that it's almost like starting over. I mean, clearly I have an in that someone who's just starting out can't just say, hi, it's me. Well, they could, but they would say, who are you? So I can get my book to a person, but just because we've even the same editor might go, I loved your last book, but this isn't working for me. And
Does that happen?
oh, sure. It keeps you completely off balance and unstable. It's you'd think, well, wait a minute, I sold X amount of books and you should just be jumping at this. And what do you mean you want me to change the name of the book and the character should be a pig instead of a cow? And it's quite a dance of back and forth always once you even get in.
Well, I don't know if this is an issue, but your books are not uniform in size. Like Dr. Seuss, all of his books are the same size and shape. Your books have all kinds of different shapes and sizes.
That's why he made it. Wow,
Well,
I have to recall all of my books. I don't know that his. I think the I can. Some of his series are, and maybe after a while they kind of did that. I can think of some of those big ones.
yes, the big ones were more subversive than the little ones.
Absolutely. But yeah, I mean, like this book, The Smell of White Dog, we intentionally picked something that was an unusual shape. It's a much taller and it's not as wide. We wanted it to pop. It's, I think, poetry in general, unless you are Dr. not Dr. Seuss, but Shel Silverstein, is it's a tough sell. I mean, I'm hoping that dogs brings people in because they like dogs, but we wanted something to think about. I used to teach a class on writing and illustration at UCLA, and one of the assignments I would have for my students would be to design a book cover, take it to the local children's bookstore or the children's section of a bookstore or a library, and the books that are face out, put your cover design with the other books and see if it pops. And if it doesn't, rethink it. Something that's going to show up out of that whole pile of books.
Pops.
So in this case, the shape I'm hoping helps.
Yeah. Well, would you mind giving us one more a sample from the
Sure. I'll
smell?
read you a longer one. It's based on our dog Lucy, who we lost on Mother's Day. We didn't
Oh,
lose her. She had
she
a
died.
time.
Yeah.
A very she was a rescue, got her from the Southern California lab rescue, and she was part lab, part golden retriever, and part goat. Never met a dog. I mean, labs are sort of known for being hungry all the time, or just chow hound. So I wrote chow hound, and it says, I can show you the picture. Well, they can't see that, but you can.
Yes.
All she thinks about is food, tasty morsels chomped and chewed. Bread, cereal, cookies, rice, potatoes, and carrots would be nice. She dreams of bean and cheese burritos. She prays you'll drop some of your Cheetos. A chow hound stares while you are eating, whines, "It really should be me you're feeding." If you drop a piece of kibble, that's a perfect chow hound nibble. A tiny treat, there's nothing greater, but it rolled under the refrigerator. A chow hound won't accept defeat. When she spies something good to eat, a chow hound has true superpowers. She'll wait there for hours and hours. This superhero's skill's unsung. She'll snag that kibble with her tongue. All she thinks about is food, tasty morsels chomped and chewed.
That's a beautiful poem, Barney
Thank you.
Salzberg. The name of the book, The Smell of Wet Dog and Other Dog Poems and Drawings. The author, the brilliant Barney Salzberg. Thank you for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
What a treat. Thanks so much.
Well, we were supposed to have the renowned author Lemony Snicket on the show this week, the author of 13 novels and a series of unfortunate events, and many other great books that everyone loves, including his latest called Poison for Breakfast, which is highly amusing. But apparently, Mr. Snicket could not join us today and sent a representative in his place, a person called Daniel Handler, of whom I can safely say he is mostly water. Daniel Handler, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm sorry it's already a disappointment.
I was a middle school teacher for a long time, so I know how popular Lemony Snicket's books are. And I also know that there are films and TV shows that are wonderful. I found Poison for Breakfast not only very funny, but serious as well. I mean, it's been a long time between books for Mr. Snicket. So is this book the culmination of some thoughts that have been rattling around the Snicket mind for some time?
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. The book took a somewhat circuitous and long route to publication, partially because, as you say, it has a lot of serious ideas bandied about in it. And it was also, it took me a while before I could really figure out if it was a book. It was an idea and I kept writing it down, but it took a while to decide, yes, this is in fact a book. This isn't merely my compulsive rambling on legal pads.
Do you write in longhand?
I do, yeah. I don't like the machine that I use to work to be also my mailbox and my television and my numerous temptations, my catalog, whatever else.
You give it to distraction.
Yeah. So I like to write longhand and then make outrageous pronouncements elsewhere on screen rather than try to combine them.
And has that always been true? Did you write all of your books on the legal pads?
No, I started when I had a baby, and the baby was very distracting, as babies are. And so I started to work outside of the house. I would leave my house and go places to work so as not to be distracted by the baby. The baby, I should add, was left in the care of responsible adults. I didn't just abandon the baby. The baby's fine now.
That's good to know.
He's not even a baby anymore, so that's how well that went. I would go and leave the house and work in a cafe or a library. And then I began to have that problem when you drink tea all day long and you're working on your laptop of what to do when it's time to go to use the bathroom. If you take the laptop with you, you look suspicious. And if you ask a stranger, if you say, I'm afraid this machine will be stolen by a stranger, so I'm asking you, a stranger, to watch over this machine. It doesn't help. So I began to write longhand because nobody steals a legal pad. And then I really liked it. I found the burden of being on screen was such a wonderful thing to relieve myself of. So I really enjoy it.
You just mentioned a moment ago that you have a child who is now 17 years old.
Yes.
So it's been a while since you started publishing your series of unfortunate events. And I think that a lot of little kids who grew up with them are now adults. I mean, adults approach me all the time and say, aren't you Mr. Shapiro? You were my teacher when I was in the seventh grade. So yeah. Is that happening to you, that children who grew up on your books are now?
No, hardly anyone calls me Mr. Shapiro. I do meet increasingly numbers of people who read my books when they were young who are no longer of any dismissible adult age. For a while, they said, I read your work when I was growing up, and I would think to myself, but you're not really done growing up, are you? But now they have children and, responsible employment. They have books of their own. And so I can no longer pretend that they are young people. They're clearly old people.
And it just feels like yesterday that you started writing in some ways.
No, it feels like 1,000 years ago that I started writing, honestly. So that's okay too. And then also I live in San Francisco where I grew up. And so when I'm recognized, it's just as likely to be, yeah, my sister dumped you in 10th grade. I remember you. So that's, it's a nice check on one's ego that, I'm subject to being recognized for an assortment of non-glamorous reasons.
Poison for Breakfast, mm-hmm. your new book, or Lemony Snicket's new book, I should say. It really feels like it's spontaneous, you're just speaking to me, but you reveal in the book that you really labor over every sentence and that there's a good deal of editing. So is it challenging to maintain that kind of casual voice?
I mean, I would say that that's the central challenge of writing literature. I don't think there are too many authors who would like to be ponderous in their prose style. I think they would all like to feel that everything makes sense and that it's moving along at the right clip. I think that's the central challenge of it. And so I had all these little pieces that I would write and then put together in different ways and try to smooth them out. And then I like to put things aside for a while and not look at it. And so then maybe the stitching will seem invisible. I mean, you've mentioned that you you teach film, which I think is probably a similar thing, having been in the editing room on rough drafts of films. Then you, when you have a new draft, all you see is all that you've changed. You know, you see the little edits and you have to get a little away from it and then watch it and say, oh, I don't miss that at all. We cut out that whole scene, which at the time seemed very crucial, but now seems utterly like half remembered. So I try to do that with my prose as well, to try to get it moving gracefully and lightly.
And you've had this, not only the experience of having your work turned into film, but you've written the films as well.
Yeah, it's a fun thing to do. It's collaborative, and which can be very challenging, particularly if you're used to being alone someplace working on your legal pad. But it feels good for the brain. And I've always liked film. And so I thought I might contribute to that art form, however meagerly.
I think everything has been very well received. And you've even had, I mean, you've done certain things twice, right? You had a film version of Unfortunate Events and a TV version.
Yes, I've done a lot of things twice, but that's but adapting a series of unfortunate events for film and then television is maybe the highest profile thing I've done twice. yeah, and that was, it was a challenge both times, building a whole world of Snicket and Baudelaire orphans on a set that you can film is, of course, a tremendous expense. And anytime someone's in charge of a tremendous expense, they're really worried. So you have to deal with kind of worried corporate types alongside the ordinary collaborative creative argument, which is a challenge and something that doesn't happen in a book, even though some books are maybe more expensive to publish than others. You know, if you say, and then they go up the stairs in a book, it doesn't cost you any more than if they merely open the door.
This book, Poison for Breakfast, it's kind of like a textbook for writers. I mean, you gave a lot of writing advice in the book.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, it's been suggested to me before that I try to write a book about writing, but I don't like books about writing. They're generally irritating and they feel phony even when maybe they're not. And the best writing advice that I have gotten is from listening and reading when authors talk about what they do, but not necessarily in order to teach you it. They just might kind of try to explain themselves. And I think that's often really fascinating. So I thought that if there was a sideways way to talk a little bit about how I make books, that maybe that would be interesting for some people.
There are many great gags in this book, and I don't want to give any of them away, but I do love it when you said, there are things that I left out of this book, and then you told us the things that you left out, therefore not leaving them out.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's just like we were saying. I mean, it is true. I put some things in the book, and then I cut them out, and I think I've become sufficiently callous that I can cut things from the book and not mourn them. But every so often there's something where I think, oh, but that was lovely. And I, you know, then I have to have an argument with myself, not unlike the arguments I've had with collaborators where I say, it doesn't matter how lovely it is. It doesn't belong there. And I say, but I really like it. Okay. And then I settle it with myself. So I thought mentioning some of the things I cut would be a way of at least having my cake and eat it too, I believe is the expression I'm looking for.
Your book is hilariously funny, really, truly funny. And it's, you're a comedian as well as an author, and there's some great running gags. Is that like an instinct to know when to put your running gag in and not overdo it or underdo it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was raised in a pretty funny family. I guess the word I'm looking for is Jewish. And so, you know, my sister and I in the backs of cars of when we were going places and around the dinner table, you know, we soon learned that a joke that isn't that funny becomes a little funnier when you say it two times, and then it becomes quite funny when you say it six or seven times, and then suddenly stops being funny and you try to make sure that you say it that one perfect last time.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of practice in the rhythm of that. I don't think of myself as a comedian at all, because I think that's a super admirable and interesting form in which I cannot compete or really even participate. I think I'm just funny for a writer, which is a nice low level to be at.
There have been some very funny writers.
Sure. But it actually reminds me of when the first season of the Netflix show was being released and it was eligible for various awards. Netflix wanted to put it in the comedy category. They wanted it to compete in the comedy category rather than in the kind of family or children's category. And I said, I don't think that's going to work, because it's only funny. It's more funny than maybe you expect if what you've heard is that you're going to watch something with your child that's about terrible things happening to orphans, then it's pretty funny. But once you put it next to shows that are trying to make you laugh every 20 seconds, it's not going to compete. And sure enough, it didn't. And then the next year they said, why don't we put it in the family category? And then all of a sudden we were delightfully funny for our genre. So I think I'm kind of the same way.
Do your influences include comedians as well as writers, or who are your influences?
Oh, my influences. I mean, I don't think any of them are comedians, you know, in terms of like a stand-up comedian or something like that. Although, you know, exposed to early doses of Monty Python and Woody Allen, if we're still allowed to mention his name.
Sure.
At a young age, I think we're pretty formative. But for the Snickerbooks, I would say it was really Roald Dahl was the big one. Mm-hmm. Sylvia Keely Snyder. And then Edward Gorey. Whose strange little books turned up in my house and were so mysterious to me. And I liked the kind of deadpan mystery. I like where humor and mystery sit next to each other. I think that's interesting because that feels like life.
Which reminds me that there are some delightful illustrations in Poison for Breakfast. Who did these drawings?
Her name is Margot Kent. Yeah, she's quite elegant. The publisher found her, so I can't take credit for it. Although, also, the publisher isn't going on all these podcasts, so maybe I should just start taking credit
for
it.
Sure, of course.
What do they know? Yes. I plucked her out of the unknown. I made her. I taught her how to draw. She'd never drawn anything before. And I said, well, why don't you try a little artwork? And then before you know it, look at her now, Margot Kent. No, she's terrific. And her illustrations have a lovely handmade quality to them. And being as the book to me feels that way, it's a little private in its thought and it's all about little scraps of paper and thinking about things, I thought it was nice to have the illustrations similarly have the appearance of being dashed off. And I think she's doing kind of what you talked about. She creates the illusion that she just rattled off this illustration in a couple of seconds. But I'm married to an illustrator, so I know that even when it looks like it's been rattled off very quickly, that actually it's been worked on.
Well, the person that you're married to, were they upset that you had chosen someone else to illustrate your book?
No, my wife and I have collaborated on a number of books and collaborated with other people. We are, we are non-monogamous.
Have an open marriage.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're chatting this week with Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket. He's the author of 13 volumes of a series of Unfortunate Events, several picture books, including The Dark and The Bad Mood and the Stick, and the books collectively titled All the Wrong Questions. His new book is called Poison for Breakfast.
Daniel Handler, tell us a little bit about, if you don't mind going over old stories, how did Lemony Snicket come into existence in the first place?
Well, it was a name and a little bit of a persona. Very early on, before I ever thought I would write for children, my first novel, The Basic Eight, makes fun of some right-wing organizations and news sources. And one thing that I liked to do when I was writing the novel was that I would call various right-wing organizations and news places, and I would ask them to mail me their materials, and so I could mock them. And then one woman said to me, oh, of course, we'd happily mail you some materials. What is your name? And when she said, what is your name? I immediately thought, don't say your actual name. Which I think is another part of being raised Jewish. I thought, don't get your list on this name of right-wing monsters. And so I said something else other than my name. And what I said was Lemony Snicket. And I liked having that name around. And so I began to write cranky letters to the editors of different papers and signing them Lemony Snicket. My friends for one birthday gave me some business cards that said Lemony Snicket. And so I used to go to bars and say that I would give them out. I would say I was in rhetoric. Sometimes I said I was a yacht lawyer, which was a phrase that I had read someplace. And I would explain that I spoke up for the interests of the yacht, like not the owner, but I spoke for the yacht. And when they said in what kind of cases, I would say international waters mostly, which seemed like a safe thing to do. They never said anything like, I wonder why this guy with a PJ Harvey t-shirt and jeans in a bar who looks maybe 23 years old has found successful employment in any way whatsoever. They never said that. They just had questions about my yacht lawyerdom. So when I started writing A Series of Unfortunate Events, it seemed interesting to me to keep that mystery that had inspired me from Edward Gorey and other books like that, to keep that intact. And so then I began to think that it would be fun to publish the books under the name of the narrator. And I had this name lying around already indulging in, nefarious and suspicious activities.
Well, so when you first started to write the series of unfortunate events, so I had a friend who wrote a book for Scholastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was called Great Sports Thrills. And he had never written for them before, but he'd written other things, and then he wrote for them.
There's something about that title that sounds redundant, but I can't figure out what it is. Great Sports Thrills.
Yeah.
And they
sent it back to him, and they said, we love this book, but you have too many big words. Can you break up all, and you don't use this word and don't use that word.
Right. So it was originally called like Tremendous Sports Thrills.
So did you get any of that? Did they say things like, I mean, obviously, it's the themes are not the kinds of themes that children's books had in the past. And so there must have been obvious objections there. But what about just like the wording and things like that? How did, in other words, tell me what happened.
It was a real blessing. It was a time of expansion and creativity in children's literature and in children's publishing. And so the short answer was that they left us alone. My editor was young then, our designer, Alison Donnelly was also young and new, and I had been paid what seemed I was most grateful for at the time, but seemed to HarperCollins a pittance. And so kind of as far as they were concerned, if I wanted to try to update the Gothic novel for young people and use as much kind of namby-pamby words as I preferred, that was on me. They wished the best of luck to me. And if it didn't work out as they suspected, then there'd be no hard feelings all around. So that was really the short answer. And it's something that I carry with me, that you can make a lot of magic by leaving people alone. So sometimes when I have the audacity to be in charge of other artists, or at least in a kind of influential situation with them, I try to create a space where they can work in peace. And I am appreciative of publishing situations that do that. We're in a more conservative time now, for sure, in children's publishing, certainly in the States and many places abroad. And one of the reasons why Poison for Breakfast is out later than someone might think is because it took a while to find a publishing house that was up for a book that was so wool gathery and that takes on a lot of serious themes. That seemed like a scary thing. And it reminded me that in 1998, when I was working on A Series of Unfortunate Events, if the same forces had been at work, I don't know how those books would have been published.
So that's very interesting. Even though you have published so many books, both as Daniel Handler and Lemony Snicket, there was, you couldn't just go back to the people who had so much success with Lemony Snicket and say, I have a new book, and they didn't just jump up and down and go, oh boy.
there was some jumping. No, I mean, in the case of this book, there were some concerns. But that's, I mean, throughout my career, there's been one concern, one place or another. So I'm not really used to that. But what I do have the luxury and privilege of doing, having published so many books, is to work with people who aren't afraid. That seems like the healthiest way to go to me. And so I try to avoid people who are frightened as often as possible.
You mentioned extreme right-wing outlets that you frequented as Lemony Snicket for.
Well, they seemed extreme in the 90s. Nowadays, yeah, they now would be considered, you know, center-left.
Yeah, but things have changed a lot. But your books are not... do you think that there's politics or political ideas in your books?
Well, I mean, not much aside from the fact that basically all books are political, right? That books are actually, they're usually advocating for the status quo, or they're advocating for something to be changed. So I think you can find political meaning, for instance, in the Baudelaires, who are ostracized by society, who encounter deeper and deeper corruption wherever they go and can't really find a safe space to be who they are and have that be their central struggle. I think you can find political meaning in that, but I don't think you can find, you know, endorsements of political candidates or reminding people to vote for local ordinances or anything like that.
So you didn't see it as an allegory for, you know, the Bush administration or anything like that?
No, and I've been, you know, adopted and rejected over the years by various ideologies. You know, I'm either, I'm often simultaneously clearly advocating and clearly offended by whatever idea it is that people are finding in there. So that feels just about right to me.
Were there any large numbers of people who just didn't get what you were doing and said, this guy should be stopped and this book shouldn't be in our schools? And
I wouldn't say large numbers. There were some determined numbers. There still are. And that's something that's changed in the landscape as well. It used to be that librarians for young people could be counted on to kind of stay the course in terms of free expression. Mm-hmm. Now they're more likely to be the people who are advocating for taking books off shelves. And so that still happens, but it's not large numbers. If it were large numbers, then it would kind of mean something. It tends to be small groups of fanatical people who see an opportunity to grab a little power.
Yeah. Interesting. So have you had a lot of experiences with, and I'm sure you did. Have you gone to schools and met with kids? And
oh, absolutely. Yeah, I have. It's something I enjoy doing. I like looking at a school. You know, I kind of, one of my favorite parts is often waiting in some classroom or some hallway where the event has yet to begin. And then I get to see the second grade papers posted or the, you know, eighth grade projects or anything like that. That's interesting to me. I was kind of hiding in the sex ed classroom once in order to go into the gymnasium. The sex ed classroom was right off the gymnasium, which felt kind of iffy to me already. But there was a fishbowl where you could ask questions anonymously. And so, of course, I read all of the anonymous questions. And by the time I'd read two or three, I already had an idea for a book, which was All the Dirty Parts, which was another book that was looked like it was going to be published for young people, and then people got nervous and it was published elsewhere. But so yeah, I like visiting a school, if only to gather information, but I also like to meet people who are interested in reading my books. I try to look for the people who seem genuinely enthused rather than the people who have been assigned to be enthused, which I think is something I can kind of smell. I often think of this time where I did a presentation for some young people and they were kind of rowdy, which I don't mind because I don't work there. But but afterwards, the principal said to them and then to me, I'm sorry they didn't act like adults.
Well, they're not supposed to.
Yeah. So first of all, they're not adults. So there's that. You can say that to a gazelle too. I'm sorry, you're not acting like an adult. But what I thought was more striking was that I actually thought they were acting like adults, that if you gathered a bunch of adults in the middle of their workday and you said, you have to come into a room and you have to sit on the floor. And then you said, like, ladies and gentlemen, Jonathan Franzen, whatever you said, someone who some people were interested in, but a lot of people would think, I was just in the middle of something else. Why do I have to sit here on the floor and listen to Jonathan Franzen? And that's how adults would act. They'd be good for a couple of minutes and then they'd get bored.
Yes. Well, I teach a class. I have to be careful what I say, but I teach a class with a lot of older people at another place. And all the older people are always looking at their phones. Like right. They're 80 and they're still looking at their phones.
Yeah. Yeah, I try not to look at my phone at all. I held off from getting a phone for so long because of the kind of distraction that I've been talking about.
Yeah.
And whenever I catch myself looking at it, and it's that horrible thing where you kind of want something to be there, and then when something's there, you know, you don't get an email that says, look under your chair right now. I've left you like a homemade cherry pie. You only get an email that says, I would like you to do something for me. Or that thing that you tried to do has not worked out. There's a complication and we need some action from you on that as well. And so you end up kind of praying for communication, and then it's not the communication you want.
Yeah.
It's not someone saying, we've invented a time machine and we're sending you back in time and you're going to be a member of Roxy Music, just like you always wanted to be. That's not the email you get. You don't get that.
Roxy Music, they were great. I loved them.
Yeah.
I spent a day with Brian Eno once. He was terrific.
Oh, yeah? Envious of you. I admire him a lot.
Oh, he's amazing.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're chatting this week with Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket, the author of 13 volumes in A Series of Unfortunate Events, several picture books, including The Dark and The Bad Mood and The Stick, and the books collectively titled All the Wrong Questions. Daniel Handler's new book is Poison for Breakfast by Lemony Snicket.
So what kind of a kid were you? Were you a good student?
I was a good student, yeah. School came pretty easily for me, I think is probably a better way to put that. There's nothing like having a kid who's in school and having his own, you know, the shape of his own education goes a different way to make you think more about your own school. And I did very well in school, but I think actually it's because it came naturally to me and that I was lucky enough to be in schools where they could support me and have enthusiasm for me where I was. But yeah, I like to read a lot. Literature meant a lot to me. It has always meant a lot to me. And so that was my most frequent companion. But I do seem to be one of the few writers who doesn't remember high school as an unending parade of gloom and terror. I had some friends. We had dinner parties. Sometimes we had a pretty good time.
And so when you started to write for kids, did you picture yourself as a child reading this book? Or did you just say, oh, this will be fun?
I sort of pictured myself. I thought about what I liked. And I tried to go into that space. Because I don't think there's any other way to do it, really. I don't think you can research and pedagogy your way into writing something that young people like. You can do that and publish something, but I don't think you can find the kind of instinctive delight that happens with different readers in different books. And so I think the only kind of reader I could really chase down was the kind of reader that I was. And there turned out to be way more of them than I had anticipated.
So what will you do? Will there ever be any more unfortunate events books? Or what's
I like that you said books. It sounded for a minute. Will there ever be any more unfortunate events? And I thought, yes, out of all the times in history, surely we can assume that there's going to be at least a couple more.
Yeah, we're done with this.
Yeah, that's right. There'll be no more, say, I don't know, variations. A series of unfortunate events is over as a series, but I plan certainly on writing more books as Lemony Snicket as much as I do as Daniel Handler. I find it an interesting space to inhabit. And I think you never love a book the way you love a book when you're 10. And so when you're interested in literature and interested in reading, I think that's a pretty crucial space to have some fun in.
Well, Poison for Breakfast seems like a book that, I mean, I found it amusing and delightful, but I can't see any reason why someone who is 12 wouldn't also enjoy it. Did you intend this book for all ages?
I mean, I think it is really a piece of children's literature at heart, if you think of children's literature as a genre, which is how I picture it. Uh-huh. You know, I don't think just because an 11-year-old likes something that it becomes a piece of children's literature. I think children's literature is a thing. And I think that all good children's literature can be read by adults. But certainly, for instance, in the packaging, we tried to work on a cover that if you were a grown-up and you were reading it on the subway, you wouldn't be ashamed to be seen with it. I think often with children's literature, there's very beautiful books to be read. But, you know, if there's like a bug-eyed talking animal on the cover of your book, you have to be a pretty brave 45-year-old to carry that into the conference room before your big meeting starts. So I think there was an eye for making it more immediately appealing to a wider age range. But I've always had grown-up appreciators of my work. So that's not very new to me.
There I was guess a because of parents, time, read their parents read your books out loud to their kids.
Well, right. I mean, that's kind of the whole gambit of children's literature anyway, right? Is particularly books for very young people. You have to kind of attract an imaginary parent of an imaginary reader. It's like an extra layer of, you know, imaginary fact-finding before you can put ink to paper. And at the beginning, I just remember that I would meet these adults who would say, oh, I brought like my friend's niece, but I really like your work. There'd be these, it's almost like you had to show ID. You had to bring a child. And sometimes and then as everyone got older in that first generation of readers, I think people finally said, you know what? I don't have to apologize for enjoying the wide window. I think I'm right here. So I appreciate that too.
Well, then you did your job as a writer for young adults, because I can tell you that I taught middle school in Salinas, California, and most of my students thought of reading as a chore to be avoided at all costs. They don't like
it. Well, we tend to teach it that way.
Yeah. And so when there was a series of unfortunate events on my desk, kids really wanted to read those. And that's an amazing thing that kids wanted to read anything.
Well, thank you. It is a blessing. I usually fault the teacher. I like that you had copies of a book that they just might happen to enjoy on their desk.
I would tell them not to touch them if those were my books.
Yeah, that's what my parents used to do. They used to read to me. They would stop at a suspenseful moment, and then they would say, time for bed, and they would put the book there, and then there would be a flashlight. And then the next day, if the bookmark had moved 20 pages, they would just read as if they didn't know the difference. And I was getting away with something because it was more delicious to get away with it than it was to sit and read. Yeah,
exactly. Well, I really love Poison for Breakfast. It's a marvelous book. And as I said, it's got a lot of serious ideas in it, and it is hilariously funny, laugh out loud funny.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I find that's how conversations are often with, I mean, my favorite conversations are all like that. Often the conversation will be with a young person, though, you know, but if you walk up to a young person at a party and you say, I was looking at this chandelier that's hanging above us and it looks like it could fall and crush us at any minute, then you'll have a very interesting conversation about death that will be quite serious and also funny at the same time. Also, possibly you'll be asked to leave the party, but those are the breaks.
Well, congratulations on this book, and thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. I hope you come back.
I would delightfully come back. I'll call first so you don't have to just sit here on Zoom waiting for my return. We'll make an appointment. But I would love to return. It's been charming talking with you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.